The following presentation, entitled Catholic Social Teaching, was originally recorded on November 30th, 2006 for Incarnation Catholic Church, RCIA.
You'll see on the board I have your scripture passages. I have some business terms there because I thought it'd be a little bit easier if you had those. And I have my outline that looks like a lot. And in fair disclosure, I did need to tell you something about this. I actually heard this information secondhand, but according to the Guinness Book of World Records, the longest sermon ever preached was about 48 hours long. And at the end, there were about seven people left, and I believe six of them were asleep. And I really think that it's very important when I'm teaching that I have people remember me and remember what I taught. So I was thinking of some really good ways to do that. And I realized that supposedly there's a winter storm coming, so there's really not any point in going anywhere. So let's get started. I have a feeling that Martha would stop me before then. You know, I might only get to about 47 and a half hours.
Maybe the first one to fall asleep, though.
But I'd be in big trouble when she woke up and I was still talking. So, let's get started for real. Now, you will recall, as we've recalled before, the story of God's plan of salvation, and that the God who is love, definitely in the Holy Trinity, He is love. He created man, it's all of us, in His love to be with Him forever in heaven. But what I want to call your attention to today is that He also created us to live in communion with one another and to live in love with one another. But if you've been alive very long, then you know that doesn't quite happen the way we'd like to. I mean, we have everything from, in fact, since Adam and Eve, our first parents, were the ones who first fell. We have marital problems. In fact, they were already sowing fig leaves on each other very soon after the fall. We've got just problems with relationships in general, in families. We see problems with a coworker that just demands having a red swing line stapler and won't give up. He'll steal yours if he doesn't have one, or somebody who doesn't show up, or people that are just not doing what they're supposed to, road rage, you name it. Because the fall affected not only our relationship with God, but it affected our relationship with one another. And when God calls us back to Himself, He calls us back to communion with one another. He gave us all a real role to play in His creation. There's this beautiful passage. It's actually part of a passage in the Catechism, paragraph 302, that says, creation did not spring forth complete from the hands of the Creator. And if you think about it, He only created directly two human beings. He gave us, by the relation between husbands and wives, a role to play in His creation. He gave us all work to do. Even Adam and Eve were expected to tend the garden. The only difference is that it wasn't quite the drudgery that it is now because of the fall. And He also gave us a role to play in salvation. In fact, He appointed the apostles to preach the gospel. He didn't just stay on earth. He ascended into heaven. He is, of course, with us here, and especially in the Eucharist. But He has people transmitting that. But there will be more on evangelization later. I believe Andy's covering that near the end. And He not only calls us individually, but He calls us as a people to be His own. And that's what He's been doing all throughout salvation history. Because when the flood came, God didn't just save Noah, He saved Noah's family. God calls Abraham. Abraham was a leader of a tribe. Then Moses became the leader of a nation of Israel, and at that point He gave them laws and the means to develop a society, which then under King Saul and then King David especially, He made the covenant with him, the kingdom, and then Jesus Christ came and established His church. He's always establishing a people. Jesus Christ never came with the idea of establishing a relationship that is Jesus and me and to you-know-where with thee. That's not how He did it. We're here to love each other, to support each other, and to help each other on our way to heaven. And one of the first obligations of that is our obligation to come together to worship the Lord. In fact, if you look at Exodus chapter 5, verses 1 and 3, God has Moses tell Pharaoh to let the people go so that they can come and worship. And we have a very serious obligation foremost to worship together. And definitely the church will tell us that if we miss Sunday Mass of our own fault, and this is not if you're sick or you just really can't get there, then it is a very serious sin. because God has a right to our worship, just as we heard a lot about liturgy just the last time. God has always been calling us to do good for one another. For example, when God calls the Israelites together, if you look in the next passage there, Exodus 22:22-24, he tells them not to neglect the widows and the orphans, or he will hear their cry. And this continues on through the early days of Christianity, especially because even the pagan emperors who were persecuting the Christians realized their charity. Like during the plagues, the Christians would take such good care of people, even the pagans, that many of them caught the plagues themselves and died. And the emperors would actually try to develop charities of their own, essentially to compete with the Christians. Once Christians were allowed to practice publicly, thanks to the edict that Constantine made, they were seen working for social change. For example, Roman law permitted abortion and even let infanticide go, especially for girls, because people wanted boys to carry on the family name, and the Christians worked to change that in society. Probably a lot of what I'm going to be talking about now, though, is fitting more of our modern society, and the popes in about the last century have written a lot of what we call encyclicals. These are letters the popes have written to the whole church about social issues. And definitely today, we just heard from somebody here, and we have been all throughout hearing about people doing charitable work. And it's important that we do this because it really makes a difference in our world and in individual people's lives when Christians live their faith and we do it in a way that stands out so that we're distinguished from that secular world that I like to make comparisons of. Our faith needs to touch every aspect of our lives, public and private. That includes, of course, being in the church. It includes the way we do our work, the way we run our family, the way we participate in public life, including the way we vote, everything. Our secular world, if you poll most of the people and you ask them if God exists, they're probably going to say yes. But very often we see businesses run, society governed, and a lot of aspects of society going as though there is no God. His life is not just as pervasive as it could be. And indeed, by our showing of love to one another and to those others, not just to people within the church, there's a saying, and I've heard it said, I believe it was even said by Bishop Dozier, but I never knew him, that we don't help people because they're Catholic, we help them because we are. And in going out in the world, we show the real truth behind Christianity, because a lot of times in the secular world, when we hear about what Christians have done, they like to bring back any problems that have occurred, whether real or not, and make it sound like Christians have just been an oppressive force, when in fact, there's been a lot of good done because of our love for God, which reaches out in love to neighbor. Now, what's the basis for all this? Of course, God creates us in his own image and likeness, and this dignity that he bestows on him, in other words, the dignity of the human person that Andy talked about, is the very basis of our social teaching. And it's important to realize the dignity that people have, because human beings are not to be used as objects, but rather to be treated with this dignity. Also, human beings, of course, form societies as God has always had them do. And it's important to understand that society exists for the good of people, not people for society. The church is not communist by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I believe that communism is grounds for excommunication if you became that. With Christ's command to love our neighbor, it brings with it the obligation to work for what we call the common good, as well as the good of individuals. And what we mean by the common good, I like St. Augustine's definition, it's something that's not diminished by being shared with others. For example, world peace. We share that with other people, it's not going to make the world less peaceful. It's going to make it more peaceful. Likewise, safety. Not having a fear of what somebody might do to us as soon as we walk out of a building. Very important. And by sharing that and helping to preserve the safety of others, the good really increases and it doesn't diminish. Also, the common good helps people to reach their fulfillment, helps them to fulfill their vocations, and to have what they need to flourish. And that's really what we're wanting to do with Catholic social teaching. Of course, in every society, especially with the number of people we have around, we definitely need our civil authority. And we do have a duty to obey the civil authority because all authority comes from God. And one commentator once said that the state acts with the partial authority of God. But I do want to put emphasis on the words partial authority, because obviously if they're telling us to do something that's sinful, then we not only don't have an obligation to obey, but we really have an obligation not to do what they say. If they outlawed going to Mass, then we would still need to go to Mass and worship God, because God's laws are a higher law. But the state, the civil governments, are charged with the common good, and therefore, because of that, unless they are contradicting God's laws, we obey them. Along with that, I want to introduce now the next set of business terms I have up there, solidarity and subsidiarity. And I'm surprised I actually said that without choking over it. That's a long word. And basically, solidarity is the love of all people as sharers in our humanity. So what does that mean? It means we're all in this together, kind of like I was alluding to a little bit earlier. But what I really want to spend a little bit more time on here is subsidiarity, because when I was reading through quotes of some of these papal encyclicals, I didn't go read through them all because, man, there's a lot written, but I got some quotes, and it was very interesting that while we need to help other people who are in need, ultimately, the idea is not to just keep them as somebody we just perpetually help, but to really do what we can, not only to work on that immediate need, because obviously, if you see a beggar out there on the street, you don't want to just say, hey, don't worry about it now. We're working to end world hunger, and in a couple of years, we'll have it. So we want to be able to help them right away. It's kind of like we're going to catch him a fish, but then after we do that, we want to teach him a fish. We want to solve the real problem. For example, I had one priest say that they had provided a shelter for the homeless, so they solved an immediate need. And then they discovered that a lot of these homeless people they were helping had substance abuse problems. So what did they do? They offered substance abuse treatment programs, and therefore hoping to solve the root of the problem so that they would be able to return to productive work and then would be able to carry out their vocation in life and be able to then help other people in turn. So that's really basically the idea of subsidiarity, is the fact that what someone can do for themselves, a higher authority shouldn't do for them. And a good example is, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, is the family. The state might be able to do things to help the family, but they should not take over the role of the family in the upbringing of children. Another term that is not up there, and actually it's called preferential option for the poor, and probably a lot of you have read Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, and essentially what this means is that in any decisions that are made and whatever we do, and especially societies and civil authorities, we need to make special consideration of the most vulnerable members of society, because our Lord will treat whatever we do for them or to them as having been done for or to himself. And he tells the people who are on their way to heaven, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. And so God rewards those things that we do for the poor and vulnerable. And because many of the people who are poor and vulnerable, it's because they're disabled, we also know that by this, it precludes judging people on their usefulness, because they're not objects to be used for profit generating, although definitely a boss can profit from his work. It's important to understand, though, that underlying these concepts that I'm going over regarding the common good and the good of individuals is that people may have different ideas on how to do this. There are things that are definitely set in stone, but there are a lot of things that are not. And a good example is if you see somebody begging you for money, you may well choose to give him money and feel like that's the best thing for him. However, you may decide to refuse him money because you're pretty sure he's going to spend it on drugs. I had somebody one time come to me asking for money. He said he needed a part for his car, and he was stranded, and he was 50-something years old and never done this before in his life, and so I gave it to him to help him. However, a few weeks later, that same guy approached me again with the exact same story. He was also visibly drunk, by the way. I knew at that point the best thing for him was not to give him the money, because he was almost certainly going into the liquor store nearby, and I realized that's what I needed to do. So now, what I want to do is to go over some of the specific goods that in our society and in ways that we want to protect. And the very first and foremost basis of the goods really is the protection of human life, because All human life is sacred from conception until natural death. And without looking at the right to life, when we start to allow the killing of the innocent, the other rights just don't really matter much. And some of the examples, especially when we talk about preferential option for the poor here, abortion, euthanasia, destruction of embryonic stem cells, these are all taking of innocent life. These are all intrinsic evils, and no politician who says that these should be allowable is fit for public office. Some people may feel, for example, this guy wants to ensure health care for all Americans, which is something that's very important, but knowing what I know about insurance, being a pharmacist, I would be very cautious about somebody who was not against taking innocent life trying to develop a health insurance plan and what they might do. Now, keep in mind that I've mentioned innocent life because if you do have somebody breaking into your home who's going to kill you, you do have the right to resist them, and if it means you have to kill the aggressor, that's not what you want to do, but if you have to, you have to. If you preferred to give your own life, you could, but if you were in the home with the family, then you no longer have that option because you do have an obligation to defend your family. Another issue that has generated a lot of controversy is capital punishment. I know that Pope John Paul II was very much against capital punishment, and people seem to believe that the church has decided that all capital punishment is wrong, and that's not exactly the case, because the traditional teaching of the church has said that in cases of necessity, the death penalty can be used. It's not what we call an intrinsic evil, and Pope John Paul didn't change that, and he really couldn't have changed that because that is the teaching of the church. But what we're saying is that only if we can identify the guilty party with certainty, and if it's absolutely necessary, then it can be used. But basically, Pope John Paul's take on it was highly unlikely, if not completely non-existent, the circumstances in which we would need to use the death penalty, and he really was calling for it to be ended. And certainly, working to end capital punishment is definitely a good thing to do. The other thing I'm not going to go into too much detail is also the waging of war. We definitely see in one of those passages, I have John 2, 13 through 22, Jesus drove those money changers out of the temple. And in a case where there's some lasting certain damage and there's not really any other way out, and there's a chance that we're going to succeed if we fight this evil, and we're not going to cause greater evil, then it is legitimate for a society to go to war. And those in charge of civil authority may well have the duty to go to war because of their duty to protect the citizens. And those responsible for the common good are the ones who will have to evaluate that. But I will say, though, that one thing about it is that even if a war itself is just, that doesn't entail that anything done in that war would be just. And certainly mass destruction of civilians is very immoral. And a lot of people I know make a big deal about nuclear weapons, and with good reason. But one thing we want to be careful about is if someone were to send an army and to send tons and tons of marshmallows onto the city of Memphis so that we all were crushed under marshmallows, the fact that they used marshmallows to do it doesn't make it any more moral. So we have to remember that basically mass destruction of innocence is wrong. Now, next to human life, the next good that's to be protected is the family. The family is called by the church the domestic church. In 1 Titus chapter 5, verse 8, St. Paul says that he who will not take care of his own family is worse than an unbeliever. Because we all have a lot to do in our jobs, we have a lot to do with our church and everything. But we have to remember that when our family needs us, those things have to be set aside, and that our family is our very first responsibility. We know that marriage is a sacrament, and it creates an indissoluble bond, which, unfortunately, it seems like our society allows pretty easy divorce these days compared to how they did in the past, and that's definitely not a good support of the family. We'll have more on marriage a little bit later when we start talking about the sacraments. And, of course, it's through marriage that children are brought into society to ensure the continuation of society. So it's very, very vital for society's survival. And that's why we give special consideration to marriage. There are certain benefits behind it. Even if a couple happens to suffer from infertility, they're still the type of relationship. Parents have a right to see to the upbringing and the education of their children. While the state may have public schools, ultimately it's the right of the parents to decide what is going to be taught to the children. And it's important to understand that it's in this context, among others, that we know that homosexual marriage is simply not possible, because it cannot bring forth new human life. Even if the state were to make some kind of legal fiction, they could not actually make homosexual marriage, because marriage is not from the state, it's ultimately from God. Because even though the state keeps a record of it, one way I like to think about it is the fact that the state didn't make us male and female and give us the ability to procreate in that manner. That was something that God gave us in creation. Moving on to number 5 there on the outline, stewardship of the goods of creation. From the very beginning, God has entrusted the earth to us for our benefit and for its protection, because we do have a duty to the environment to preserve it for future generations. Now, it's perfectly legitimate for us to use the plants, the animals, for food and for clothing. It's perfectly legitimate for us to domesticate animals, to have pets, or to do some work, and even to do scientific experimentation on them if we need to. All those things are legitimate. However, we should not be causing them to suffer and die needlessly or destroying our environment needlessly. Also, we have to be careful of becoming overprotective of our environment and of the animals. And you see it on TV, they're spending so much money on animals that would probably be better spent on people. I've actually heard of one couple that spent like $1,000 on a wedding for a couple of pugs. Compliments of one of our team members who's kind of on leave of absence. He sent it to me in email. I think so far we're pretty well on schedule here. And I, of course, want to talk about the good of work. We actually have a duty to work. If you look at Paul's second letter of the Thessalonians, chapter 3, verse 10, it says, "Anyone who will not work, neither shall he eat." However, I want to make sure that before I get in trouble, that I do say that if you are a stay-at-home mom, you are definitely working. In fact, I'll have patients that tell me that they're a stay-at-home mom, and I'm like, "Oh, you got that 24/7 job." So it doesn't necessarily mean working for a living. And I know a lot of retired people that are out working in the church, being RCIA team members, or perhaps some of the things that they did for a living they're now doing to help other people. That's definitely work, and that's all a very good thing. And I know in the work that I do, I very much enjoy it, and I kind of envy those people who are retired because they can do this kind of stuff, which I really love doing this. The people who do, of course, have to work for a living do have the right to a just wage, a wage in which they can raise a family. Although, of course, they've got to be careful. We don't want to try to demand so much that we're really damaging our business. In fact, that becomes counterproductive in the end. We don't want to have a class struggle or some kind of adversarial relationship, because definitely corporate greed becomes a problem these days. You may see some stories of a CEO that's taking home $20 million, meanwhile he's laying off all these people or something like that. But there can also be union greed too, and definitely workers do have the right to unionize and to collaborate to receive just working conditions, but they don't need to be trying to take down the business either. Now, definitely people who work also really have a right to have some leisure time, to have some time where we're not having to work. We can leave the BlackBerry in the closet or in the Mississippi River. If I had one of those, it's probably where it'd end up. No, because here I've actually heard some statistics that we spend more time at work in an average year than the Germans and the Japanese. I've heard a couple of different theories on why that is. I've heard they are more productive per hour than we are, so that may mean that either we're all burned out or they work harder while they're at work, because I actually have seen something else that says the average person at work spends about 2 hours a day wasting time on the internet. So maybe we just need to get our work done and go home, be with our family. And there may be people who are there because they're just running away from something, which is really sad, because I don't know if any of you have really noticed this, but one thing I have kind of noticed is that it seems like people are a lot more isolated from each other these days. Sometimes the work is their only little social place, or they're spending so much time working, they're just not hanging around together. Television probably has a lot to do with that too. I had a friend who had that theory, and that may be too. I know a lot of people, and I know I don't know all my neighbors right around me. When I was growing up, I did. I grew up in a small town. I knew if I did anything and somebody saw me, I was going to hear about it again from my parents, who heard about it from the person who saw me because they knew my parents. Okay, one more good to talk about, and that's the good of private property. Catholic social teaching does defend the right to have private property, but not the absolute right to have private property. I will give you an example here of what we call, last business term, universal destination of goods, which basically means that really all the goods of the world are ultimately there for the whole human race. Just think about when they had Katrina blowing through New Orleans and the people who were stranded there. Obviously, the people who owned the grocery stores and whatever they needed for food were probably not around. And about the only way these people were going to get any food is if they went ahead and made use of what was in those grocery stores. Now, the TVs, the stereos, the liquor, I kind of doubt that falls under this. But definitely, if they need food and medicine and whatever, they can make use of those goods, and it's not considered stealing under the commandment, thou shalt not steal. The church definitely considers very strict capitalism to be a kind of economics of greed, but also does support private property because, actually, I read one statement, I believe it was by Pope John Paul II, said socialism was the politics of envy, or economics of envy. And to give you an example of why the church would favor ownership of private property is this concept that I actually remember hearing in some of these forums that I went to, is that we're more likely to take care of our own. And I think that some universities, in the way they fashion their dorms, have actually gotten a hold of this concept, because I've heard now they build them so that like the facilities are shared between a couple of rooms instead of in common like they were even when I was in school. Because if you think about it, even though this isn't really ownership, if you're one of either a very few people or the only one that is going to be held responsible for that area and people are going to know it's you, you are a whole lot likely to create literary works on the bathroom walls. Yeah, that was bad, I know. And ownership of property does not have to be equal among everybody, but if you have more, you definitely need to share with those in need. So now, the conclusion. And to think we aren't yet at 47 hours yet. There's so many kinds of things that need to be done. And the devil would probably love to have us know everything that needs to be done at once so that we will know that there just isn't any way we can do it. The important thing to do is to find out what God has called us to do, first of all. And we may not be called to support, say, I know the cathedral has this mission to Haiti. You may not be called to go to Haiti for that, but definitely you would want to support them financially, at least, if you can. And even looking at, say, the businesses we do business with, as best we can, I mean, you can't research every little thing, find out what kind of causes they support, things like that that we can do. And we definitely want to watch out for greed in our own lives and consumerism, when we're looking to buy things, whatever, sometimes we need to stop and think, do I really need that? I must say I'm talking to myself as much as anybody, because look at all this equipment back here. So I have a lot to learn about this too, that we're all in this. We need to look at definitely getting what we need, but also how can we share and can we help other people? Thank you.